Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's good to get some notebook paper and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, I'm going to look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. From an article in The Contrarian, the monetization of U.S. government debt, we're watching and it's bigger than you think. First, it'd be good to know what it means to monetize. That means to convert government debt from securities into currency that can be used to purchase goods and services. Now back to the article. Didn't Chairman Bernanke say the Federal Reserve will not monetize the debt? Yes, he did. As clear as day to the House Budget Committee back on June 3rd, 2009. And yet, 17 months later, Bernanke gave us QE2, which not only means the Federal Reserve will be purchasing about $75 billion a month in assets for the next 8 months, but as it so happened, some $110 billion in Treasury notes and bonds too. That's enough to finance the U.S. government's projected fiscal deficit right up through June 2011 in full. The Contrarian's take, what gives? Echoing his June 3rd testimony, said Bernanke to Congressman Ron Paul and the House Financial Services Committee on July 21, 2009, we are not intervening or actively trying to make it easier for the government to issue debt. Well, QE2 may or may not be aimed at monetizing the debt, but monetizing the debt, and in robust fashion, it nevertheless is. At The Contrarian, they love to crunch numbers. So, we ask the question, just how big are these debt monetization activities in light of historical precedents? Given the impact these activities have on the currency and bond markets, we're thinking it's something we all want to know. What we found is that these activities are a whole lot bigger and a whole lot more pervasive than even we thought. Before we show you just how big and pervasive, some preliminaries. The traditional take on U.S. government debt monetization activities is centered on U.S. Treasury debt and the Federal Reserve. To wit, the Federal Reserve purchases or monetizes Treasury debt by issuing checks on itself, in effect printing the money with which to purchase the debt. Certainly true, but in our minds, too narrow a view for two reasons. Treasury debt is not the only government debt, and the Federal Reserve is not the only central bank actively monetizing government debt. What other government debt is there, you ask? The obligations of the government-sponsored enterprises, agencies Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. On December 24, 2009, recognizing the dire state of the housing market, a market that just so happens to be dominated by the agencies, Fannie and Freddie, the U.S. government gave the agencies already in conservatorship and under government control unlimited access to the U.S. Treasury, effectively making them divisions of the U.S. government and their mounting losses the government's own. On that date, the long-standing implicit guarantee bestowed on agency debt by the U.S. Treasury was turned lock, stock, and barrel into an explicit one, making agency debt obligations the de facto debt of the U.S. government. In our minds, that means that when the Federal Reserve buys agency debt, in a very real way, it is monetizing the debt of the U.S. government. And the second point, Federal Reserve not being the only central bank monetizing debt. Again, just to try to make this understandable, monetizing means to convert government debt from securities into currency that can be used to purchase goods and services. So the Federal Reserve has some friends that help it monetize both treasury and agency debt. Those friends are the central banks of the world, largely the central banks to America's Asian trading partners. They buy U.S. treasuries and agencies in large quantities by printing their own money with which to do it, not because they are really friends of the Federal Reserve, but because in their eyes it lends support to their country's export-driven economies. The Federal Reserve relishes their help because the bid those central banks provide for the U.S. dollar, for treasuries, and for agencies is a bid that would be left largely to the Federal Reserve. James Grant, editor of Grant's Interest Rate Observer, has a way with words, so we will let him explain the how and the why. Consuming much more than it produces, this country, America, discharges its debts in dollars. Having no use for dollars, their recipients, America's Asian creditors, sell them for local currency, which their local central banks duly print. The dollars, meanwhile, go winging their way back to America in exchange for treasuries and agency securities. So far, so sweet. Everybody seems to win. Asian asset markets levitate, and treasury yields collapse. But the sheer volume of dollars emitted, treasuries purchased, and Asian currencies printed should make even the most sanguine bond bull stop and stare. As Grant opines, the benefit the Federal Reserve receives from the monetization activities of these foreign central banks appears to be a clear win for the Federal Reserve, the U.S. dollar, and the U.S. government bond market, for as long as these banks and their respective governments find it worth their while. The problem is the other side of this debt monetization partnership is a whole lot of monetary inflation, both in America and abroad, a situation which clearly cannot last forever. That, though, is a subject for another day. So looking at these concepts with numbers, have a look at the monetization activities of the Federal Reserve and foreign central banks goes as follows. As of the second quarter, June 2010, the Federal Reserve held 25.7% of the U.S. government's public held debt outstanding, up from 15.1% fourth quarter of 2000. And as for foreign central banks, they just love U.S. government debt, holding 37.1% of outstandings, up from 19.1% fourth quarter 2000. All told, as of the second quarter 2010, the monetization efforts of the Federal Reserve and foreign central banks stood at a combined 62.8% of public held debt outstanding, 1.8 times the fourth quarter 2000. Not a bad deal if you're the U.S. government with a want-to-run trillion-dollar deficits. Nothing like being able to pay your bills via the printing press, right? If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now back to monetization and looking at the numbers. Zeroing in on the important role played by foreign central banks and taking a look at 12-month monetization flows, Federal Reserve versus foreign central banks. Clearly, the foreign central banks have been the Federal Reserve's best friend these past 10 years. Well, actually, the last 30 years. Not only have they been taking on a steadily increasing share of the U.S. government's debt, but they have often been found filling the funding gaps left by the Federal Reserve. The funding provided by foreign central banks during the housing bust turned credit crisis turned Great Recession when the Federal Reserve liquidated a large part of its treasury holdings to help finance its plethora of credit crisis loan programs is an example. While it's likely the Federal Reserve provided a portion of the monies that helped its central bank friends fill that particular gap, One cannot help but wonder what deals were being struck at that time. Fill the gap they did, however. In the final analysis, and for whatever reasons, foreign central banks have been monetizing a lot of U.S. government debt for years. Monetization responsibilities that would have been left largely to the Federal Reserve. And the article goes on about U.S. government debt monetization and the series that's being created. And that's in the Contrarian Take databank. Now that article actually leads into a whole broad topic that I'm going to attack and share with you for months to come about debt in America. And our research tool and textbook will be The Web of Debt, The Shocking Truth About Our Money System and How We Can Break Free. And this is by Ellen Hodgins Brown, who's an attorney. I highly recommend it right from the start, and it will not only be a read that is accessible to most middle-class people, but it will be an eye-opener to everyone. This analysis will really give everyone a broader understanding of how we arrived at where we are nationally, and of course, the trickle-down effect to each one of us in the economy, whether we have money, we don't have money, we're dealing with a large amount of debt in bankruptcy or no debt at all. We will see how we are pieces in a giant chess game that, frankly, as individuals, we do not control. I'll start with chapter one, Captured by the Debt Spider. Ellen Brown starts with a quote by Hans Schnicht, The Death of Banking, from February 2005. And he says, through a network of anonymous financial spider webbing, only a handful of global king bankers own and control it all. Everybody, people, enterprise, state, and foreign countries all have become slaves chained to the bankers' credit ropes. Now that's a big statement, but we're going to work our way through the history of it and some very enlightening facts that are woven together by Ellen Brown. We go back to President Andrew Jackson, who called the banking cartel a hydra-headed monster eating the flesh of the common man. New York Mayor John Hyland, writing in the 1920s, called it a giant octopus that seizes in its long and powerful tentacles our executive officers, our legislative bodies, our schools, our courts, our newspapers, and every agency created for the public protection. The debt spider has devoured farms, homes, and whole countries that have become trapped in its web. And this may not only sound familiar to some of you, but feel familiar to many of you. In his book, The Death of Banking, financial commentator Hans Schnick states that he had an opportunity in his career to observe the wizards of finance as an insider at close range. Their game, he says, has gotten so centralized and concentrated that the greater part of U.S. banking and enterprise is now under the control of a small inner circle of men. He calls the game spider webbing. Its rules include making any concentration of wealth invisible, exercising control through leverage, mergers, takeovers, chain shareholdings where one company holds shares of other companies, conditions annexed to loans, and so forth, and exercising tight personal management and control with a minimum of insiders and frontmen who themselves have only partial knowledge of the game. Dr. Carol Quigley was a writer and professor of history at Georgetown University, where he was President Bill Clinton's mentor. Professor Quigley wrote, from personal knowledge of an elite clique of global financiers bent on controlling the world. Their aim, he said, was nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. This system was to be controlled in a feudalist fashion by the central banks of the world acting in concert by secret agreements. Now, he called this clique simply the International Bankers. Their essence was not race, religion, or nationality, but was just a passion for control over other humans. The key to their success was that they would control and manipulate the money system of a nation while letting it appear to be controlled by the government. Well, the International Bankers have succeeded in doing more than just controlling the money supply. Today, they actually create the money supply while making it appear to be created by the government. The ruse was revealed by Sir Josiah Stamp, who was a governor of the Bank of England and was thought to be the second richest man in Britain in the 1920s. He gave a talk at the University of Texas in 1927. Quote, "The modern banking system manufactures money out of nothing. The process is perhaps the most astounding piece of sleight of hand that was ever invented. Banking was conceived in inequity and born in sin. Bankers own the earth. Take it away from them, but leave them the power to create money, and with a flick of a pen, they will create enough money to buy it back again. Take this greater power away from them, and all great fortunes, like mine, will disappear, for then this would be a better and happier world to live in. But if you want to continue to be the slaves of bankers and pay the cost of your own slavery, then let the bankers continue to create money and control credit." Professor Henry C.K. Liu is an economist who graduated from Harvard and chaired a graduate department at UCLA before becoming an investment advisor for developing countries. He calls the current monetary scheme a cruel hoax. "When we wake up to that fact," he says, "our entire economic worldview will need to be reordered, just as physics was subject to reordering when man's worldview changed with the realization that the earth is not stationary, nor is it the center of the universe. The hoax is that there is virtually no real money in the system, only debts, except for coins, which are issued by the government and make up only about 1/10,000th of the money supply. Now listen to this. The entire U.S. money supply now consists of debt to private banks for money they created with accounting entries on their books. It is all done by sleight of hand. And like a magician's trick, we have to see it many times before we realize what is going on. But when we do, it changes everything. All of history has to be rewritten." So now what we're going to undergo is to study and track the web of deceit that has engulfed us in debt. And Ms. Brown is going to present a simple solution that could make the country solvent once again. And it's not just her. She is backed by many great economists and scholars in this country who are looking behind the curtain, just like in The Wizard of Oz. It's not a new solution, but dates back to the Constitution. The power to create money needs to be returned to the government and the people it represents. And I'm going to repeat that. The power to create money needs to be returned to the government and the people it represents. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. I just ended with a major point, so I'm going to repeat it once again for the third time. The power to create money needs to be returned to the government and the people it represents. The federal debt could be paid, income taxes could be eliminated, and social programs could be expanded. And this could all be done without imposing austerity measures on the people or sparking runaway inflation. Now, of course, this may sound utopian. It does, as I said, represent the thinking of some of America's brightest and best, and it includes Abraham Lincoln, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, giants in the field of American life. Over time, we're going to explore some arresting facts. First, the Federal Reserve is not actually federal. It is a private corporation owned by a consortium of very large multinational banks. Point two, Except for coins, the government does not create money. Dollar bills, Federal Reserve notes, are created by the private Federal Reserve, which sells them to banks, which then lend them to the government, individuals, and businesses. Point three, tangible currency like coins and dollar bills together make up less than 3% of the U.S. money supply. The other 97% exists only as data entries on computer screens. And all of this money was created by banks in the form of loans. Point four, the money that banks lend is not recycled from pre-existing deposits. It's new money, which did not exist until it was lent. Five, 30% of the money created by banks with accounting entries is invested for their own accounts. Six, the American banking system, which at one time extended productive loans to agriculture and industry, has today become a giant betting machine. By December 2007, an estimated $681 trillion were riding on complex, high-risk bets known as derivatives, 10 times the annual output of the entire world economy. These bets are funded by big U.S. banks and are made largely with borrowed money created on a computer screen. Derivatives can be and have been used to manipulate markets, loot businesses, and destroy competitor economies. Point seven, the U.S. federal debt has not been paid off since the days of Andrew Jackson. Only the interest gets paid, while the principal portion continues to grow. Point eight, the federal income tax was instituted specifically to coerce taxpayers to pay the interest due to the banks on the federal debt. That's why we're paying taxes, folks. If the money supply had been created by the government rather than borrowed from banks that created it, the income tax would have been unnecessary. Contrary to popular belief, and this is point nine, creeping inflation is not caused by the government irresponsibly printing dollars. Don't blame the government. It is caused by banks expanding the money supply with loans. Point 10. Most of the runaway inflation seen in banana republics has been caused not by national governments printing money for the nation's needs, but by global institutional speculators attacking local currencies and devaluing them on international markets. Point 11. The same sort of speculative devaluation could happen to the U.S. dollar if international investors were to abandon it as a global reserve currency, something they are now threatening to do in retaliation for what they perceive to be American economic imperialism. And the last main point, there is a way out of this morass. The early American colonists found it, and so did Abraham Lincoln and some other national leaders. The government can take back the money issuing power from the banks. Now, all of that was a huge mouthful, and it could be contorting some brains out there, but we will move ahead and in a piecemeal fashion, basically expand on each one of these points, which in a lot of fundamental ways will be personally liberating in terms of our place and role in the economy. Now, the bankers' Federal Reserve notes and the government's coins represent two separate money systems that have been competing for dominance throughout recorded history. At one time, the right to issue money was the sovereign right of the king, but that right got usurped by private moneylenders. Today, the sovereigns are the people, and the coins that make up less than 1/10,000th of the money supply are all that are left of our sovereign money. Many nations have successfully issued their own money, at least for a time, but the bankers' debt money has generally infiltrated the system and taken over in the end. These concepts are so foreign to what we have been taught that it can be hard to wrap our minds around them. But the facts have been substantiated by many, many reliable authorities. And here are some examples. In 1934, Robert H. Hemphill, credit manager of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, wrote, "We are completely dependent on the commercial banks. Someone has to borrow every dollar we have in circulation, cash or credit. If banks create ample synthetic money, we are prosperous. If not, we starve. We are absolutely without a permanent money system. When one gets a complete grasp of the picture, the tragic absurdity of our hopeless position is almost incredible. But there it is. It is the most important subject intelligent persons can investigate and reflect upon." Which, of course, is why I'm speaking it out to all of the intelligent out there. Graham Towers was the governor of the Bank of Canada from 1935 to 1955. He acknowledged, "Banks create money. That is what they are for. The manufacturing process to make money consists of making an entry in a book. That is all. Each and every time a bank makes a loan, new bank credit is created. Brand new money." Robert Anderson, Secretary of the Treasury under Eisenhower, said in an interview reported in 1939 in the U.S. News and World Report, "When a bank makes a loan, it simply adds to the borrower's deposit account in the bank by the amount of the loan. The money is not taken from anyone else's deposit. It was not previously paid in to the bank by anyone. It's new money created by the bank for the use of the borrower." And a last example, Michel Chasudovsky, professor of economics at the University of Ottawa, wrote during the Asian currency crisis of 1998, "Privately held money reserves in the hands of institutional speculators far exceed the limited capabilities of the world's central banks. The latter acting individually or collectively are no longer able to fight the tide of speculative activity. Monetary policy is in the hands of private creditors who have the ability to freeze state budgets, paralyze the payments process, thwart the regular disbursement of wages to millions of workers, as in the former Soviet Union, and precipitate the collapse of production and social programs." Today, Federal Reserve notes and U.S. dollar loans dominate the economy of the world. But this international currency is not money issued by the American people or their government. It is money created and lent by a private cartel of international bankers, and this cartel has the United States itself hopelessly entangled in a web of debt. By 2006, combined personal, corporate, and federal debt in the United States had reached a staggering $44 trillion, four times the collective national income, or $147,312 for every man, woman, and child in the country. The United States is legally bankrupt, defined in the dictionary as being unable to pay one's debts, being insolvent, or having liabilities in excess of a reasonable market value of assets held. By September 2008, the debt of the U.S. government had hit a breathtaking $10 trillion. Local, state, and national governments are all so heavily in debt that they have been forced to sell off public assets to satisfy creditors. If governments everywhere are in debt, who are they in debt to? The answer is that they are in debt to private banks. The cruel hoax is that governments are in debt for money created on a computer screen, money they could have created themselves. And I'd like to end with a credit, as the thoughts, ideas, examples, and text used in this program are directly from and based on the work of Ellen Brown, J.D., and I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt management.